Welcome back to Love and Understanding. My name is John Driggs, your host. Today, I'll be talking with Lene Butler. Lene is a licensed marriage and family therapist who holds a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology and a Master of Science in Molecular Biology. She founded Bay Area Mental Health, where she helps people with trauma, PTSD, depression, and anxiety using a number of modalities, including DBT, sensory motor therapy, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, among others. In our conversation, we discuss the difference between shock trauma and developmental trauma, common struggles in relationships, shadow work, attachment styles, parts work, somatic work, and much more. I found this conversation to be incredibly useful, and I hope you do too. Now, before I bring you Lene, let me just remind you that I provide my work free from advertisements, but it's only because of your support that I can do this. So thank you if you've already subscribed to my work, and if you have not, please consider subscribing at my Substack page. Even a cup of coffee means the world to me. And if you're not in a place financially, your presence is always welcome. One final note, I'll be hosting a loving kindness retreat in Bryan Head, Utah, from July 22nd through the 26th. This will be a great opportunity to connect more deeply with yourself, to bring more love and compassion to yourself, which in turn will allow you to connect more deeply with your friends and loved ones. And now I bring you Lene Butler. Well, I have Lene Butler with me here today. Thank you, Lene, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I have been watching your work on Substack and have really enjoyed the maturity and openness that you're bringing to healing and more broadly the spiritual realm. Now, I want to get to the work you do in your therapy practice and spirituality, but before, I would like to explore your intellectual background because you have quite an interesting story there. You studied under a Nobel Prize winner here in my home state, Utah, at the University of Utah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that journey?
Sure. I have a very non-traditional journey to becoming a therapist. I started out in molecular biology and genetics. And I actually went to Utah specifically because I was interested in the work of Mario Capecchi, who I ended up doing my graduate work with.
Yeah, and he's a molecular geneticist, right, that is famous for the knockout gene?
Yes, for gene targeting using stem cells. So actually, it's a really cool story. He's an amazing human. He was an orphan, a World War II orphan growing up in Italy, and he became a scientist. He wrote his initial grant to do gene targeting. And the NIH said, that's never going to work. We're not going to approve it. So he wrote a different grant and then used the money to do the gene targeting work. And the NIH came back and said, thank you for not listening to us. So it was incredible to work under him. And then from there, I worked in Big Pharma. I worked at Pfizer for a while. And while I loved the intellectual side of molecular biology and genetics, I was missing the sort of humanitarian part, the people part. And I started considering other kinds of careers, and I landed on marketing. I was like, people. There's people in marketing. I'm going to work with people. So I went into marketing and discovered that marketing actually was not so much about people. It was much more about the money. And as I was climbing the corporate ladder and being very successful in that career, I was also going through my own therapy. So I'm a trauma therapist because I'm a trauma survivor. And surprisingly, I was becoming more unhappy. Like, this doesn't make sense. I'm doing my healing work. I'm successful in my job. Why am I unhappy? And I don't know who first said it, but the ladder I was climbing was against the wrong wall. So I went back to school for psychotherapy, and specifically transpersonal psychotherapy. So that is how I ended up being a therapist. Very non-traditional.
Yeah. So how was that transition in the beginning? Were you still working through some of your own trauma as you started being a practitioner?
Yes, but I didn't realize it at first. So like when I went to graduate school, I thought the second time around, I'm like, oh, this is going to be easy. I'm done my healing work. I'm done hardcore grad school and sciences. This is going to be a cakewalk. It was not. Because there are so many layers to healing.
Yes.
And what I discovered, it was really not so much in grad school proper, but I started training in somatic psychotherapy while I was still in graduate school. And that was the work that helped me contact a deeper layer of my own healing that needed to happen. And I would say that by the time I was licensed, I really had worked through it. But in the process of going through school and doing the somatic training, it just took me deeper.
Yeah.
And then later on, I became a psychedelic psychotherapist, and that took me again sort of a level deeper.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to get there, but maybe let's pick up on this first thread. I want to just ask you, in your practice, what do you think people most kind of misunderstand about trauma, especially those who think they've kind of fixed it or they're over it?
Oh my gosh, so many ways to answer that question. One thing I'll say is graduate school does not prepare you for working with trauma. And there are entirely too many therapists out there who think that just because they have worked with somebody who has trauma, that they know how to do that work, and that is not the case. I am very much a vocal proponent of, if you're going to work with trauma, you need trauma-specific training. So that's one piece. Another piece is the nature of trauma. And I think that the understanding on this is growing. Certainly, it's much better understood now than when I was in school. But trauma is not just 9/11, going to war, catastrophes. That's shock trauma. But the other kind of trauma, it's developmental trauma, chronic childhood trauma, and that's what my specialty is in. And so understanding the difference is very important, because there are certain approaches that work very well for shock trauma, like EMDR is outstanding, but it's not so good for chronic trauma. And in my Substack, I write about Chloe, which is a pseudonym for a client that I spent 10 years with. And she has had, she no longer meets criteria for PTSD. She had developmental trauma. And I remember one of the first sessions when she came into the office, she was like, okay, so 6 months, we're going to be done in 6 months. I got a smaller. No, but no, we're not going to be done in 6 months. I don't know when we'll be done, but when it comes to trauma, the slower you go, the faster you get there. And so often people come in and they want to plow through the work and dive deep and clean it out and go through catharsis. And that is not necessarily what they need. If anything, their nervous systems need to be slowed down so that they can learn to regulate. Their nervous systems are already heightened and moving very quickly. And so we need to slow everything down.
Yeah, let me untease some of those. So first, you mentioned EMDR for shock trauma. Just for my listeners who may be unfamiliar with EMDR, can you just briefly explain that modality and how it may be useful for a particular group?
Sure. EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. And it is a approach using bilateral stimulation. And that can be like somebody might move their finger across your field of vision and you follow it with your eyes. Or you can use tappers where you're holding on to these little things that buzz.
Or audio.
And it's a way of, or audio, yes. Like with the bilateral music.
Right.
It's a way of trying to get the left brain and right brain to talk to each other. And it's still a bit of a black box as to how it works. But it essentially helps to move a traumatic memory into long-term storage in your mind. So it doesn't feel like it's happening to you every day.
Yeah, that's fascinating. My partner, who has had shock trauma and developmental trauma, she has found it incredibly useful for relaxing her nervous system.
Yes. And there's, I do want to mention that there's sort of a newer form of EMDR called attachment-based EMDR. And that one is more appropriate for chronic trauma survivors. And I should say, I'm not an expert in EMDR. I have had training, but it's not one of the modalities I practice. So I cannot speak as like the authority on EMDR.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, no, let's transition to this developmental trauma. I often see a lot of people avoid their own trauma, who that they're afraid to claim that I have trauma, you know, because someone may have had shock trauma. And so they feel like, no, I can't say I have trauma. But, you know, many of us have these little punches every day that build up over time. So, yeah, maybe speak a little bit more to this developmental trauma.
There is this phenomenon in trauma survivors, and I call it the comparison trap. And it's like, well, but that person had it so much worse than I did. So what right do I have to be experiencing suffering? And the answer to that is that it's not in the narrative of what happened. It's not the chronology of what happened. It's how it was experienced. So, for example, I'm going to refer to 9/11 and people who were at Ground Zero. You would think, oh, of course, all of them have PTSD, except they didn't. About 60% of the people who were there did get PTSD, but 40% did not. And they all experienced the same thing. The difference is the amount of resiliency in the system prior to the event. So, for example, Coke, this is a wonderful analogy that one of my professors used. She said, if there's an earthquake, say a 5 earthquake in San Francisco, the first earthquake, it's going to do some damage, but maybe the buildings don't come down, but there are then cracks in the foundation. And then the next time you have an earthquake, same exact magnitude, what you're going to have is buildings collapsing because there are cracks in the foundation. So if the resilience is strong, if you've had a childhood with secure attachment, close attunement, and you have a solid foundation, then you're less likely to experience PTSD. And the same is true for chronic developmental trauma. It's all in the perception and in the internal experience rather than the external events that happened.
Fascinating. So what would you say to some of these people with this comparative mindset that may encourage them to look inward and hold themselves a little differently?
Yeah, this is not a hypothetical because I say it frequently, and that is your suffering matters. Your suffering is real. There's no comparison. And just because other people have experienced pain doesn't mean that it was greater than or less than yours. And that comparison sort of backs you into a corner. So I try to encourage people to really let that go and be with their own experience instead of trying to justify the suffering that they're experiencing.
Right.
And I would say right now, you know, given this, the status of the world, I think we're all traumatized. to some degree. If you're paying attention, you're traumatized.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there is so much suffering in the world right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about couples. You know, I think most of us who have long-term relationships, we find that some of the ugliest parts of us come out in relationship. Can you speak a little bit to why that is?
I think I'm going to make a comparison to social media.
Okay.
And Facebook, for example. What people present on social media is what they want the world to see. So it's not the authentic person. It is an avatar that they have created. And we do that with the people that we know. So like if I'm walking down the street and I see someone, I'm going to smile, I'm going to say hello. And even if I'm feeling terrible,
I
prefer to present the best side of myself. And then when I get home at night, and sometimes this happens for me as a therapist, I go in and I have to be fully present for my clients, even if I'm not feeling particularly well that day.
Yeah.
And so it takes, I sort of tap the reserves for that, and I'll come home and I don't have enough left over for my husband. And it's unfair, and that's something I try to manage. But I think that with less self-awareness, that lack of availability for the people closest to us can turn into being unkind.
Yeah.
And I think that the masks come off.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I don't know, maybe you can just react to this, but for me, I feel like there's also just this element of safety that we think we're more secure to take off the mask in front of.
Yeah, and I think a part of us really wants to drop that. You know, I can be my absolute authentic self with my husband, and I'm so incredibly grateful for that. He's seen me at my best, he's seen me at my worst, and he loves me anyway. So there's tremendous safety in that. Now, if all I ever gave him was my worst, that would not be very fair. So it's sort of about titrating our energy so that we don't give away the best of ourselves to the people who are the least close.
Mm-hmm. I like that. What other patterns do you see that repeatedly derail couples?
One thing that can be challenging is when a couple has a child, and their first child, and you can almost imagine like two people facing each other and all of their attention is on each other. And then you have a child and all of a sudden the attention shifts to that child, which is as it should be. And yet it can be very painful for the partner who's used to getting all of that attention that it is now shared. So that sort of needs to be navigated carefully, because you do need to provide, especially in the, you know, youngest years of the child's life, you need to provide a total and complete presence, and it's very demanding.
Yeah.
But somehow you also need to carve out time to be with your partner, whether it is, you know, have a date night, get a babysitter, stay in a hotel, have some private time to make sure that you remember why you fell in love, why you came together, and why you made this child. So that's one thing that can be challenging. Another pattern that can be challenging is when people are unaware of their own shadow. And shadow work is an area that I'm very interested in. But when you're unaware of your own shadow, it tends to come out in those closest relationships.
Yes.
And it can get ugly. It's one of the reasons that I believe so strongly in therapy. And I don't just mean therapy for symptom relief. I also mean therapy for doing the shadow work, for continuing to peel that onion and look for deeper and deeper layers of healing so that you don't project the unconscious things in you onto your partner.
Yeah, no, I personally can relate. I mean, my partner and I are like a hall of mirrors because I have this need for safety and stability. She's got this need for freedom. So as soon as mine kind of tightens up, it's like, no, I need freedom. And so, yeah, they kind of hit up against each other. But luckily with that self-awareness, we can just say, oh, hey, look, we've got our triggers are talking to each other. Can we just take some space and come back to this? But yeah, so what advice do you have both to look at, examine, discover your own shadows and triggers, as well as to work with them skillfully?
One thing that I think is important is to understand attachment patterns. And you just described a very classic pairing of, and I hope you will forgive me if I make some assumptions. And
sure, no.
No, I mean, I could be completely wrong.
Go for it.
There is a pattern of anxious attachment coupling with avoidant attachment. And what you described, I think, is that you're the more anxious partner, needing that security and reassurance, and your partner is more maybe a little bit avoidant, and, you know, she needs some freedom. And in my relationship with my husband, I'm the anxious one. So here we are with two anxious attachment people talking to each other. My husband is more avoidant. And I don't do a lot of couples work. But if I did, there are sort of two schools of thought. One is you have to do your individual work before you can be in relationship. And the other is you can actually heal in relationship something that you can't heal individually. And I fall into that camp. And I can tell you from my own experience that my attachment wounds, my husband's attachment wounds, we essentially both came to a level of healing through the relationship that we would not have gotten to individually. So like knowing your attachment style and understanding how that shows up, knowing your partner's attachment style, understanding how that shows up, and understanding how the two can dance together is very helpful.
Agreed. Yeah, I learned a lot about myself through the relationship.
Yeah.
So is it useful to talk therapy here, some form of IFS, internal family systems? What do you recommend for couples or individuals?
Well, I think it depends on the person. I'm a big fan of parts work. I'm IFS informed, but not like IFS certified. I do a lot of parts work, and I think that can be very helpful in either individual or in couples therapy. For somebody who needs some symptom relief and they just want short-term therapy, that might be something like CBT.
Can you expand on therapy? Right. And that kind of shapes habitual thoughts and behaviors, right, in a strategic way.
Yeah, it's a behavioral strategy. It tends to be short term. A typical CBT protocol would be 12 sessions versus the kind of work that I do. I will often work with clients for years, but I'm also working with complex, highly acute clients that CBT may not have been appropriate for. Another option is dialectical behavior therapy. It's another therapy I'm trained in that I'm a big fan of. That's really good for stabilization, for learning coping skills. Not so much for shadow work, but that could be like the first layer. You do DBT to learn the skills and the coping strategies and create stabilization. And then you can go deeper with psychodynamic or somatic psychotherapy or parts work or, I mean, many modalities.
Right. So let's pick up on some of those, some of that somatic work, because just looking around, being in this current state of the world, you can feel the tension in people's beings. And often, and I think, correct me here, but with a lot of that developmental trauma, we don't necessarily have a story for it, or there is just, it's tied up in our body. So can you speak to, somatic work and how it can be helpful?
Sure. And just by the way that you're talking about sort of picking up on the energy, I'm going to take a guess here that you might be a highly sensitive person. Would you say that describes you?
Very. Yes.
Okay. As am I. So as
it's overwhelming at times.
What's that?
It's overwhelming at times.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
You know, if you are highly sensitive, you're literally picking up on more data than somebody who is not. More stimuli is coming into the system, which means the system can get overwhelmed much more easily. And it means that people like us who are more sensitive need to do a lot more self-care, a lot more energetic self-care. It's probably why I was drawn to somatic work. Somatic work, and there are many different approaches, but the two that I'm most familiar with are somatic experiencing and sensory motor psychotherapy. Sensory motor is what I turned in. I would also bring in Diane Fosh's work, Hakomi. Those are some other branches of somatic work. And it's a way of using body awareness as a method of accessing the unconscious material. So for example, if I had a client who came in and we're talking about something, and she started like rubbing her throat and might say something like, "Okay, what are you noticing here? You noticing, does it feel like there's like, you know, something stuck here, like something?" You know, my throat feels tight. That actually can be an indicator of words that were not safe to say. So we use the body sensation to access the underlying material, versus if I just asked her, like brain to brain, what is it that you're not saying? You mean, what am I not saying?
Right.
I'm telling you everything. This is what happened this week.
Right.
I sometimes use the analogy of, when you're doing purely brain-to-brain communication, it's like going in the front door, and the front door is typically well-guarded. That's where you have the light. You might have a, you know, Nest camera or something like that. All the guards are up on the front door. If you go around the side door, there are less protections. And so using body awareness, whether it is a tightness in the throat, discomfort in the belly, tension in the legs, which might indicate like a subconscious desire to run, then you can use that to access the beliefs that are underneath. So I think it's a wonderful way to access shadow material. It's also a wonderful way to work with trauma, because it's very safe and it doesn't tend to be re-triggering.
Fascinating. I really like that metaphor. So once you've done some kind of somatic release or somatic work, is it then paired with talk therapy or something, some kind of framework for them to work through whatever beliefs rise to the surface?
Yes, it is, for the way that I work, which is sensory motor or somatic experiencing. It may or it may not be, depending on the practitioner. Sometimes it is just working with the sensations in the body. I have recently just met with somebody who is a parasympathetic coach, and she works only with the body. She's not a therapist, and she's been teaching me things about the nervous system that I thought I understood, and she's teaching me a much deeper understanding of the physiology of fascia and what happens in the body when we are in sympathetic, which is the fight-flight mode, versus when we're in parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest mode. Right. So again, it depends on the modality, whether or not there would be talk therapy with it.
Sure. And I would imagine the particular personality too would determine which would be more appropriate. So I tend to draw people that are on the spectrum, people with OCD, philosophically, intellectually, verbally minded people. Are there any particular exercises or modalities you find more useful for that type of person?
For the hypercognitive ones?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because I have a background in science and because my practice was located in Silicon Valley and recently relocated to Europe, but because of those two things, I tended to see quite a few hypercognitive types. And I mean, I fall into that category as well. That's my safe space. For those folks, getting them into the body is really important. And that can be very difficult because it's almost like there's a board right here. And it's like, this thing, the only purpose that this serves is to carry my head around.
Yes.
My body is my head delivery vehicle. So getting those kinds of folks to try and drop into body awareness, interoception, that's a really important part. And it can be very challenging. It might be something as simple as, can you feel your heart rate?
Yeah.
Like I can feel my heart rate right now, but for somebody who couldn't, I might say, okay, you know, go ahead and put your fingers on your carotid and feel your heart rate there. Okay, now see if you can feel it in your chest. And training them to notice what was previously sort of beneath their awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think for some people, like people on the spectrum, for example, correct me if I'm wrong here, but like proprioception may be underdeveloped in people with autism. So one of my kids, for example, they're on the spectrum, and as you said, it's almost like there's a board separating them from their body, you know, and they may be walking up the stairs, which are made of hardwood, and they hit their shin really hard, and we all kind of like, oh, you know, but no problem. They go on as usual. So
it's because they don't know where their body is in space.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I see that. And so if there is a physical component there, is there still a way to help cultivate that? Like with
absolutely.
Okay.
So people who are autistic will often have difficulties with both proprioception, which is where is my body in space?
Right.
And interoception, which is what am I feeling inside my eye?
Right.
You can train that. And most therapists, let me rephrase that. Some therapists may be able to help with that a little bit. But the ideal approach would be occupational therapy.
Yes.
Where you're actually using sensation to help them understand, like, where are my fingers? Where are the tips of my fingers?
Right. Right. Yeah, it can be quite a challenge, I think, for parents also with kids on the spectrum, worrying about their kids kind of how they're relating to others, knowing what roughhouse is too hard or too aggressive, or, you know, respecting boundaries.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to teach things cognitively that other people would know intuitively or by watching someone.
Right.
For example, every culture has sort of a rough distance that is comfortable. And in Western culture, it's typically the length of my arm. Like, if you're standing about an arm's length away, that's probably going to be comfortable, more or less.
Right.
For somebody who's autistic, they may have no awareness of that, so they need to be taught that cognitively.
Yes.
My stepson is autistic. And this was actually something that I worked on with him when he was in junior high and high school and struggled to understand sort of what physical space felt comfortable to people.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that it can be really difficult for them because they have to learn this whole societal song and dance. It's like, I don't have a rule book for this. Like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's very confusing. And yeah. So much about autism has been misconstrued and misunderstood. Like the idea that autistic people don't have empathy.
Right.
That could not be further from the truth.
Oh my god.
If anything, the
deepest feelers and yeah.
Yes. Yes. But they express it differently.
Yeah.
So I'm neurodivergent myself, and I actually have come to the conclusion that we don't have a freaking clue what is happening with autism and ADHD.
Yeah.
You know, all the research was done in a very small population. I was grade school aged male.
Mostly men.
White children.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it looks different to women.
Yeah.
It looks different to different cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my daughter and my partner both are on the spectrum too, and it just shows up very differently from my son. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're just now beginning to scratch the surface. And I think it's really more of a nervous system organization than it is a disorder. I think labeling it disorder really does a disservice to the people
Agreed.
Who are neurodivergent.
Okay. I know you have a hard stop at the hour. So let's shift here into your work with psychedelics as a healing modality. Personally, from an early age, was kind of a psychonaut, an explorer. Always privately, you know, but for my own personal journey, psychedelics have been of tremendous help. I grew up in a quite devout Mormon home, and it never really connected for me. Around 12, it was just like, I have questions that you guys are not answering. And anyway, I moved to this very skeptical mindset, you know, this strictly scientific, almost materialist mindset. And so psychedelics in my late teens, early 20s, really shifted that perspective. It's like, oh, there's something bigger or something more here that is worth investigating. So I don't know. Anyway, yeah. So tell me about what particular medicines or psychedelics you're using and how successful you're finding them.
Sure. I should say that I was a very straight-laced kid.
Okay.
My stepfather, his first career was undercover narcotics. So I was not an early psychonaut. I came to psychedelics through the route of trauma therapist. And because I had worked in pharmaceuticals, I was familiar with how clinical trials go. I'd been watching what was happening with MDMA. And it was progressing. And I was like, okay, MDMA is for trauma work. I want it when it's available. I want to work with that. So I reached out to somebody who was one of the investigators on the clinical studies. And I met with her and I said, so how do I get ready for when this, because I had assumed, I think like most of us, that the FDA would approve it. We were all quite shocked and dismayed that that did not happen. Anyway, she said, well, you know, you can do the training with MAPS, which I did. So I'm trained to work with MDMA. And she said, and you can get practical skills right now using ketamine. And I was like, oh, no, ketamine is a medical procedure. It's in the emergency room for suicidal patients. I want to do therapy. She said, no. We're using ketamine and doing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. I went, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll sign up for the first training and see how that goes. And on that very first day, I was blown away. It felt like I was coming home. it resonated so deeply with me. And I think I was very blessed to be trained by the group that I did my training with, Polaris Insight Center in San Francisco. They hold these medicines as deeply sacred. And so that was my introduction to the work. So I'm trained to work with ketamine, MDMA, and psilocybin.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the only one legal in California is ketamine. So that's what I worked with professionally. And I ran consult groups for a while. Now that I've moved to Europe, unfortunately, ketamine psychotherapy is not a thing here.
Oh, interesting.
So for me to, it's a little slower here. There is some of the work happening in England, Portugal, and Switzerland, but not in the majority of Europe. And so for me, if I want to do this work, I need to travel, which is fine. I'll travel when I need to do that work.
Sure.
And I can still do some ketamine psychotherapy virtually with ongoing clients who I've been working with for, years. And the success rate. There's two ways to answer this. One is with the ketamine work I've done, which I've done quite a lot of it. And I've been blown away by some of the results. When I first started in the ketamine psychotherapy field, it was really thought that this was a treatment for depression, specifically treatment-resistant depression. Not really for PTSD. I didn't find that to be the case. I found it to be very powerful for PTSD, or anxiety, for rumination, for working with those deeply held limiting beliefs. And some of the results were mind-blowing. On some of the assessments, they scored very high on PTSD and depression scale. And after a series of treatments, it had dropped down to, I think in one case, it dropped to 20% as the original number. It's dissociative. So you sort of leave your body. And this is the other thing that was interesting. In sort of the early days of ketamine psychotherapy, it was thought, you don't give this to somebody who dissociates. Mm. However, you have to be cautious and you have to have a practitioner who knows how to work with dissociation, but it actually can have the effect of the person who dissociates. They leave their body under the ketamine, and then when they come back in, it's almost like they reground into their body.
Yes. I've had people who have a lot of trauma or they feel uncomfortable in their body or pain always. And so there is a dissociation. You detach and you almost, there's this undeniable recognition that you are so much more than your body. You are allowed to come into this vast open space and meet that transcendent element to this non-dual reality that we are. And when they come back in, it's like, oh, okay, I do feel safe in my body. I can connect to my body because I have this greater capacity that I have met and recognized.
It's actually one of the reasons that I have found ketamine to be very helpful for autistic people.
Yes.
Because the nervous system is so overwhelmed, it gives them a little time out. And it's kind of like a sensory safe space for the mind, for the psyche.
Yes, absolutely. My partner would agree heavily.
The other way to enter this is the data from the MDMA clinical trials, which was even more astounding. And what they showed was that 70% of the people who went through the clinical trials that had refractory PTSD, after 3 MDMA sessions, did not qualify for that diagnosis anymore. That kind of recovery rate is unheard of.
Yeah.
Which is why it was so shocking that the FDA made the decision that it did.
Right. Yeah. With MDMA and also MDA, a close relative, I find also particularly useful for PTSD because there's an openness of heart. There's ability to examine things or let that trauma come to the surface, and there's an ease, a vast unconditional love that it brings. So there is a safety that's there to hold and examine the trauma.
And DMA is it's an empathogen. It's a heart opener.
Exactly.
And what it does, it calms down the fear center in the brain, the amygdala. It calms that down so that you can process the trauma without being terrorized by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm excited for that. I don't know what the timeline. Have you been following it?
It is very unclear. And part of the problem is that the FDA doesn't know how to handle a treatment that is a combination of a molecule and therapy. Because the FDA has oversight over the molecule, but nothing over therapy. And what they've asked for is a repeat of the clinical trials with MDMA, but no psychotherapy, which I think is a terrible mistake.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, we're about at the 5-minute mark, so is there anything left unsaid that you think would be useful for my listeners? Do you want to tell our listeners where they can learn more about you?
Sure. So you can find me on Substack. The name of my Substack is How Healing Happens. And the idea behind it is sort of bringing my left brain and right brain together. What is the mechanism of action that, how does healing actually happen? And the other place that you can find me is, if you are in California, I founded a clinic called Bay Area Mental Health that is in Silicon Valley. It's under new ownership, but I still work there part-time. But you can find me at either location.
Great. Yeah, and just to piggyback on your Substack, I love that you open up frameworks rather than this either-or mindset. You know, it's either the scientific view, not the mystical or the therapeutic, you know. It's like, no, it can be all of these. We don't need to limit ourselves.
I'm all about the both and.
Yes, both and. Yeah. Powerful. All right. Well, Lene, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah. No, it's been a delight. Yeah. All right. Well, until next time.
All right. Take good care. Bye-bye.